Health and Human Services Committee Tuesday, April. I'm sorry, this says April 12th. That can't be right. May 3rd. I have to be careful. I just don't read off the paper. We've got two bills, Senate File 1269 and Senate File 1174. We do have a quorum, even though it doesn't look like it. We have members who have alerted us to their presence. And so we will be able to take action on bills. Senator Benson, are you ready? And which is your preference? Did you want to take them?
We could begin with Senate File 1269, Mr.
1269. Senate File 1269. Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I am presenting today Senate File 1269. I do have some oral author's amendments as we begin today.
Did you say you had an author's amendment for 1269?
It's going to be oral.
Oral amendment. Okay. Please.
On line 1.6, cross out the words annual report and place the word forecast. And on line 1.8, cross out the number 30.
So,
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Newman.
Could you repeat that, Senator Benson?
Senator Benson?
Mr. Chair and Senator Nino. I'm sorry, Senator Newman. Line 1.6, cross out annual report and place the word forecast. And on lines 1.8, cross out the number 30.
So if I understand it, Senator Benson, then it would say forecast on children's health care service, and then on 1.8, beginning November 2011.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
We can treat that as an author's amendment. Are there any questions on Senator Benson's author's amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Bill as amended is before us.
Mr. Chair and committee members, a simple addition to the twice annual reports that we receive on the Department of Human Services budget currently. There's a line item that is families with children, and I would like to see it broken out to families with children and a subcategory of children so we have an idea how much of our families with children money is actually being spent on children. It will help us get some clarity on the programs that we develop for children. And I'm happy to stand for questions. I do have a representative from Gillette Hospital who, if you need to, help you understand the impact of what this would mean for them.
All right. Are there questions from the committee members? Questions from the committee? Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I am just wondering if this is going to increase the costs in any way, if DHS already tracks this by age.
Senator Benson?
Madam Chair, I did not check with the department, or I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, I did not check with the department, but I would welcome them to the table if somebody's here who can give us that information. I don't anticipate it would be a lot of additional work, but if someone can help clarify.
Is there anyone from the department here that could comment on that question? Not seeing anyone.
Maybe we could request that information from the department.
Sir Bergen, yes, we will request that from the department.
Mr. Chairman, I'm John Deal. I'm with the Larkin Hoppen Law Firm, and we represent Gillette Children's, and we're favoring this legislation. This was developed in close communication with the department. I don't think that the people we actually worked with are here today, but the language was drafted by them, so there would be no fiscal note, no financial implications. It'll be a part of a data run that they already do, and the only thing about this is to make sure that this is available on this schedule every year. So it's, I have an email that from them that said there's no budgetary implication. That's all we have to prove it.
Okay. Any other questions on Senate File 1269? Senator Benson, does this need to go to another committee or? What's the path that you envision for this bill?
Mr. Chair, no one else has asked for this, and so I'd ask that we pass it to the floor.
All right. Senator Benson moves Senate File 1269 be recommended pass and sent to the floor. Any questions on that motion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is passed. Thank you, Mr. Deal. And Senator Benson, did you want to now take up Senate File 1174?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I am presenting Senate File 1174, developed by the department, and so I will ask them to come up and give us supporting information on this bill.
Okay. Are there representatives from the department who can speak to the bill?
Speaking to them earlier.
I think they're on their way.
Well, okay. Thank you. Thank you. Would you like me to present
this? Really bad this is not grammar. Not my reading glasses. Okay, you got that. Great.
Welcome to the committee. I'm not sure who's going to testify first, but please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Sharique Tilnick. I'm the manager of the Child Care Assistance Program for the Department of Human Services, and the child care provisions are in Article 1 of this bill, so I'll testify first.
Could you please bring the microphone close so that we can catch your comments and record? Thank you.
So I'll try to organize the descriptions kind of by the concepts that are being promoted with the changes and tell you which sections that the changes are in the bill so that you can follow along. Article 1, Section 1 is a change that allows us to accept applications without requiring a signature within 15 days. This aligns with other program areas in the Department of Human Services and makes some consistency across programs so that we can move forward with online application procedures. Sections 2 and 3 are changes to the parent fee requirement in the Child Care Assistance Program that aligns with the system requirements for the administrative system, MEC squared. We can't do monthly co-payments in a statewide system. We have to do biweekly because the time periods have to be the same amount of time for each co-payment.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Benson.
And I do have a question that I have not had the opportunity to address.
Mm-hmm.
We are moving from $5 a month to, it appears, $4 a month. What is the fiscal impact of that change?
20%. Senator, there isn't a fiscal impact to that. The change reflects months generally are more than 4 weeks. And so the math was worked out, and it came to $2 for a biweekly period when they were building the system.
So on an annual basis, the dollars collected are identical?
Yes.
Thank you.
Sections 4 and 5 are aligning the background study requirements for license-exempt providers with the same background study requirements for licensed providers in Minnesota. Originally, those were established separately from the licensing requirements. They were very closely aligned with the background study requirements for licensed providers. Over the years, those background study requirements have changed, and CCAP statute hasn't been updated to reflect those changes, so we're just referring to the licensing statute now so that there's consistency across the thing.
Senator Newman.
Going to page 3, section 4, I just have a couple of questions. Is the non-licensed family care providers, does that include, for instance, family relatives or friends that are providing daycare services for parents?
Senator and Mr. Chair, yes it does. Legal non-licensed child care providers can be any provider that a parent chooses that is exempt from licensing requirements. And so in some cases, those are relatives and friends.
Senator Newman.
And under current law, are those non-licensed family child care providers required to conduct a background study, or is this just more inclusive in terms of a background study?
The license-exempt providers are subject to background study requirements under current law. This is just making the reasons why they can't be approved to be the same as they would be reasons for not being approved as a licensed provider.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Newman.
It looks like what's being added here is in the non-licensed provider, a background check has to be completed on someone who is in the house who has reached the age of 10 years but not yet 13. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Senator, that's an option that the counties can implement. It's not required, but counties can choose to do that if there's reason to believe there should be a check.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
The statute, the new language, says the county shall perform.
I believe the last sentence is if the county has reasonable cause, as defined under 245C.02.
That, Mr. Chairman, would be my follow-up question, Mr. Chairman. What is reasonable cause under that statute?
Is that defined in the statute, or?
I'll check. Mr. Chair, yes, it is. Reasonable cause means information or circumstances exist which provide the commissioner with articulable suspicion that further pertinent information may exist concerning a subject. The commissioner has reasonable cause when, but not limited to, the commissioner has received a report from the subject, the license holder, or a third party indicating that the subject has a history that would disqualify the individual or that may pose a risk to the health or safety of persons receiving services.
So the way that would work, if somebody made a report in some way to the department saying that some person who may have a parent that is running a daycare in their home, that this minor might have some issues, and that report were to come to the department, and the department would have reasonable cause to seek a background check on that individual. Is that kind of what that's?
That's my understanding. The counties do the background checks for licensed family child care providers and for licensed exempt providers. And the licensing division in the Department of Human Services does the background checks for the center-based providers. So while I believe that's my understanding, I can't give you a definitive answer on that.
Who pays for the background check? Is that a fee assessed to the provider, or is that something that the county absorbs?
For licensed exempt providers, the counties can charge a fee to the provider.
So in the case that they decided that there was a reasonable cause, they would do a background check on the child and then charge the provider with the cost of that. What is the cost of a background check? Do you know?
I believe they're about $20. Again, I'm not the definitive answer on that. There's the limit that that counties can charge licensed exempt providers, I believe, is $100 per year for registration fees.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess my basic question is if we are dealing with the situation of a non-licensed provider, which often is friends and relatives, why are we expanding this to reach down to have a background check on a child of, say, 10 years of age? You know, what's the rationale for the change?
The department's rationale for this change is to simplify the administration across programs, and so using consistent standards for licensed providers and licensed exempt providers at the county level makes their job simpler because they're doing the same thing for each set of people.
So are we, in effect, treating non-licensed providers as licensed providers in this instance? Is that sort of the effect?
Senator, this only applies to the background checks. Licensed providers have a number of other standards that they have to meet, so this is just the disqualifiers under the background checks.
Have there been, to your knowledge, problems with respect to minor children ages 10 to 13 that this is addressing? Is this in response to some problems that have been revealed?
I have not heard of any problems in the child care assistance program administration. I would imagine the discussion around problems with children from 10 to 13 years old would have been discussed in the venue of the licensing standards.
Senator Higgins.
But, Mr. Chair, it seems to me I've seen in the newspaper or heard television or radio in the last couple of years where there have been instances where some child of this age has been discovered to be harming or molesting some child who's been, part of the daycare crew there. And so this may be in response to that sort of situation. Hopefully it'll never happen again, but...
And Senator Higgins, I'm sure there are younger children who have issues and so forth. I guess one question I have would be, does this affect the willingness on the part of non-licensed providers to continue to provide care, or would this discourage them saying, well, I don't know that I want to have my, adolescent kids undergo a background check that I have to pay for in order for me to watch the kids of, is that something that's been considered, or is there an effect on the willingness of people to do this if they're non-licensed?
Senator, Mr. Chair, in the year when the background check requirement was implemented, it was strongly supported by county agencies, and Hennepin County was doing it with all the providers without having a requirement to do it. So the counties felt strongly about the need to do the background checks on legal non-licensed providers for the health and safety of kids. In the year that it was implemented, we did see a significant drop in the number of license-exempt providers in the child care assistance program. We did not have the resources to do research to find out why those providers no longer chose to do care. It wasn't necessarily because the background checks disqualified them, but they knew something about themselves that made them choose not to go under the background checks.
Are there other questions, that, Senator Hall?
Thank you, Chair. Or could it possibly be that they didn't have the finances to pay for a background check?
I'm not remembering exactly if the registration fees were implemented in the same year as the background check requirement. I could check on that.
Okay. Senator Higgins?
Mr. Chair, I don't think paying for the background check it would be a hindrance to most anybody. If you go to the front door of the BCA and right inside the lobby, I think you can do it yourself for about $8, $9, something like that. If the department requires that you go to the big, beyond our own state background check, then that's more. But if it's just a Minnesota only, it's very modest in price.
I think your testimony was... I think you said that the county could charge up to $100, but that you're not sure exactly what they do charge in this case. Is that
Each county makes an individual choice about how much they want to charge for registration fees. There's a limit on how much they can charge. Some counties who feel like they need to recruit more providers or are having trouble getting providers for their families sometimes waive the fees.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still a freshman around here, but can you answer if I provide health care for my grandson?
Child care.
Pardon me?
I'm sorry. I think you meant, Senator Hall, child care, not health care?
Yeah. Thank
right.
you.
All right.
Thank you. Child care for my grandson. Am I a non-licensed child care, or what makes me a non-licensed child care?
Senator Hall, you can be a licensed exempt child care provider if you are caring for children from your own family and one unrelated family in Minnesota. These requirements under the Child Care Assistance Program are only for providers who are paid with public funds.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions on this provision? If not, I'm sorry, Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, it's not our question, but... you have to wade all the way through the sentence to see the provision about when the county has reasonable cause as defined by. And I think for clarity's sake, that should be moved up to the beginning of the sentence. So I think I'll move that. We should move the phrase when the county has reasonable cause on, as defined under blah, 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 the end of the sentence. On 3.31 and 3.32, and move it to the beginning of the sentence on 3.29, adding a comma after it.
Okay. Do members understand what the amendments are was offered to council? Is that clear, and does that work? I think my reading of it does work. I'm just questioning if we have got the...
Works, doesn't it?
Sir Higgins has an oral amendment to delete the language beginning at when on 3.31, extending to the end of the sentence on 3.32, and moving it before the underlined language on 3.29, and putting a comma after that clause. Senator Benson, any?
I am amenable to that amendment.
Okay. Are there other questions on that amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
This is 2-0, you and me.
The amendment is adopted. Are there other points that members would like to make on this? If not, please continue.
Mr. Chair, next I'm going to go to Section 7, which is another simplify administration piece. And I'm going to skip Section 6 and Section 9 for right now, which are our program integrity pieces. Section 7 is changing the requirement, the state requirement, to do the market rate survey in the child care assistance program to once every 2 years. Currently, it's a requirement to do it annually. It's a time-intensive process, and it's only required to be done once every 2 years by the federal regulations. And so we're simplifying the program by doing less frequently. Section 8 is updating the credentialing language, rate bonus language in the child care assistance program to align with the current naming of credentials that are already in the statute and to align with the career lattice that is being developed by Child Development Services for family child care providers. Sections 10 and 11 are changing the child care resource and referral statute to more...
I'm sorry, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If we could go to line 10.13. Oh, maybe I'm... Senator Higgins says we haven't been there yet. What section were you just testifying on? I thought you were on Section 9. But
I was doing Section 7.
Oh, I'm... my apologies.
And then
my apologies. We'll go back to Section 7.
I will get to Section 9, though.
I'm sorry.
Right.
And then Section 10 and 11 are changing the child care resource and referral statute to more explicitly reference supports for improving child care quality. The last two changes that we have in this bill are Section 6, which is a section that is requiring child care providers to maintain written attendance records, including the time of arrival and the departure times. This is intended to improve program integrity and to allow us to match up the authorized...
I'm sorry, but I don't know where you were at in the bill.
Senator Newman, I think we're on Section 6. I think you kind of reviewed some of the first article and...
It starts on page 7.
Starting on page 7, at the bottom of page 7, Section 6, extending over the top of page 8.
Okay, thank you.
So any child care providers who are caring for children that receive child care assistance payments will be required to maintain written attendance records with the time of arrival and time of departure for the children. This is intended to improve program integrity in two ways. It allows us to match our child care authorizations against the times that the kids are actually in care when we have reason to believe that we should look more closely at that. And it also helps the licensing division to monitor their staff-child ratio requirements for licensing purposes. And then Section 9 is something that others...
just 1 second. Senator Newman.
It was actually me.
Senator Higgins,
for
sorry.
Once, he was louder than me. Ms. Katilnik, do we pay by the day or do we pay by the hour when we are providing a subsidy? I'm struggling on why we want the exact time they arrive and the time the kids leave.
Ms. Cotillo.
We make our authorizations based on the hours that the parents need care. If the parents need care for more than 5 hours a day, we can pay up to a daily rate. If they need more than 35 hours of care in a week, we can pay up to a weekly rate. Otherwise, we pay an hourly rate in the child care assistance program. For all of the licensed providers, licensed exempt providers, are paid on an hourly basis.
And, Mr. Chairman, this is the first time we're actually going to find out whether somebody, what time somebody arrives and what time somebody leaves?
Ms. Cotilde.
There have been attendance record-keeping requirements in the statute for a while. Providers have been able to choose what form they want to keep those in. In recent times, we've had reason to believe that knowing the hours that the kids are there would help us to understand whether providers are operating over capacity or whether they are actually caring for the kids during the time that the kids are authorized to be cared for.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
Page 8, beginning at line 8.1, these attendance records that you are talking about would involve the non-licensed providers. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Senator, this would be licensed and licensed exempt providers.
And so what you are proposing, Mr. Chairman, to require the non-licensed providers, such as Senator Hall had described, to keep track of when children are dropped off, picked up, total number of hours in attendance. Has any consideration been given to the burden that you are placing on essentially family members to keep track of these kind of records?
Ms. Cotillon.
Mr. Chair, again, this is only for providers who receive payments with public funds through the Child Care Assistance Program. It's not for the general public.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
But it is for the non-licensed providers also, is it not?
Ms. Cotillon.
Yes, it is.
Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any scenario, the language in this section, referring to the same language here, refers to when a child was dropped off and picked up. Is there any scenario where a care provider would be coming to the child where a child's not dropped off or picked up? And if so, how would this language apply? If not, that my question's moot.
There are some situations in Minnesota where families can use an in-home provider, so the provider comes to the home. In those situations, the time of the provider arrival or departure would be the way we would implement this.
Okay. Senator Nino?
Mr. Chair, so your understanding is that this language would be adequate then?
Yes.
Ms. Cotillon.
Okay. Mr. Chair, yes.
All right. Other questions on Section 6? Seeing none. You were, I think, starting Section 9. Is that correct?
And Section 9 is a program integrity preventative move on the part of our state. Our neighboring state, Wisconsin, has had a significant number of issues with child care provider payments with center-based programs, and in some cases the center-based programs were employing a high number of child care assistance recipients with large numbers of children for the express purpose of collecting subsidies, and there was a big investigation. We don't believe this is happening in Minnesota, but Wisconsin has passed legislation to limit the number of child care assistance program employees that can be employed by an organization and have their children in care with the organization. This would put a piece similar to that in statute in Minnesota in case the situation ever arises.
Senator Newman?
Mr. Chairman, line 10.13.
I know, what would you do without me?
Thank you for your assistance, Senator Higgins.
Line 10.13, there is a description of a child care authorization. Could you describe for me what that authorization is?
Ms. Katilnik.
Authorization is essentially the approval for use of child care assistance for payment.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Newman.
And that authorization that you are then talking about, that would deal with the attendance records issue that is described back in section, I think it was 6, correct?
Correct.
So if we have a non-licensed child care provider who doesn't accurately keep the records that are being required in Section 6, their authorization could be withheld. Is that correct?
Correct.
Even if the incomplete records were, say, inadvertent.
That would allow Mr. Chair,
sorry.
That would allow the department to withhold payments. It would not require the department to withhold payments. The circumstances that we sometimes see now are that there are providers who are going through a revocation of licensing process for reasons of operating over capacity. And that's all in process, but we are still paying a significant amount of child care assistance program money to the provider while this is happening. So if the attendance records show that the kids aren't actually in attendance or there's something that's not up to par, it would allow us to stop the child care assistance program payments.
I see. All right. Thank you. Other questions? Ms. Katilnik, please continue if you've got additional.
I think I'm done.
I think you're done. All right. Okay.
Section 1. Yes.
I think that's Article 1. Is that?
That's Article 1.
That's Article 1. Okay. Senator Benson, do you have another testifier for Article 2?
Mr. Chair, Article 2, I have the A1 amendment.
Members, you should have the A1 amendment in your packet, I believe, or is it being distributed now? And we can treat this as an author's amendment.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Newman?
Senator Benson, at this point, is it your intention to go through the balance of the bill? Because we did skip some.
Senator Newman,
of Article 1.
I think we caught up those. I think there was a... I think we covered every section of Article 1. We just didn't do it sequentially.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, could I go back into Article 1 for a couple of questions?
Sure. Before we deal with the amendment, let's go back and do that. Senator Newman, what's your question?
Yeah. And I apologize. I obviously got confused. If we could go to page 4, line 18. This new language talks about a subject of a background check that is determined to have a disqualifying characteristic under, and that it goes on to name a couple of statutes. And to me, a characteristic is something that is subjective. Could you explain, Ms. Kototnik, what is meant by that language, disqualifying characteristic? What are the defining or disqualifying characteristics? Are they objective? Are they subjective? What are we dealing with there?
Ms. Katilnik?
Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, the characteristics are, if you look on lines 4.29 and the following four pages,
we've seen this before.
The stricken language. You're referring to the stricken language?
The stricken language, correct. Those are lists of things that are characteristics for disqualifiers under the licensing statute. So these disqualifiers that were in our statute are similar to but not exactly the same as the ones in the licensing statute, but it would give you an idea of what the characteristics are.
I think we saw this list of offenses the other day. I think Senator Higgins raised some questions about
you and I both did.
How much we want to prevent people who've had issues in the past from ever doing anything in the future. But I think it's the same list, if I'm not mistaken.
Mr. Chair, I think it's that we update that other list, but we don't necessarily come back and update this list. So we're just referring to, I think what Ms. Katilnik is saying is we're going to just refer to that other list. So when we make changes every year and adding more people into it that right. can't have jobs.
And Ms. Cotillo, is that what 245 C14 to 15, that's the list?
Yes.
And so we're striking this from this part of the statute because it's duplicative
and referring to the list that gets updated more regularly.
Okay. Senator Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I I think I understand now, because when I read it, it appeared to me that we were identifying disqualifying characteristics that were then being deleted from the statute, and that was my concern. These disqualifying characteristics will, in fact, be itemized, even though we are striking these out of this particular portion of the statute.
Correct.
Ms. Cotillo.
Mr. Chair and Senator, they are in the licensing statute, 245C.
All right. 4 and 5. Thank you. Any other questions on Article 1 before we take up Article 2? Senator Benson, or your other testifier is here, is that correct, Article 2? Or you have an amendment?
I have the A1 author's amendment to Article 2.
We have members' author's amendment, the A1 amendment. Senator Benson has moved as an author's amendment. Any explanation that we need on this?
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jane DeLage, and I am the manager for the MFIT policy section. The amendments before you are changes that are made to Section 3. In Section 3, we were working to clarify some of the policy around the family cap. What you have is consistent with how the cap has been implemented, and we wanted to be sure that that was clear in statute. There were some instances that were not directly addressed in the statute, and so we wanted to clarify that we do count the months of being on assistance across units, so that if someone is in more than one unit, you look to see if they were on assistance in another unit at the time that the child was born. When we did that, one of the impacts was that in some cases the effect was not what we had intended, and so we wanted to clarify that a child who had been excluded under the policy, or would have been excluded under the policy if they had been in this household, would be excluded, and that we were not trying to discourage people from marrying who had children themselves, so that it would not apply that suddenly if you combined households but there were no children that had been born during the time that born to those two parents during the time that it would not apply to them. We also wanted to be clear about who the cap applies to, and that families that were where the parent was ineligible or excluded, and that's the page 14, line 31, where the parent was ineligible, excluded from the family unit, but receiving assistance for their children, that the family cap did apply. It was our understanding that the idea was that you would not receive additional money for additional children that were born while you were on assistance, or conceived and born while you were on assistance. And so we felt that that, to be fair, needed to apply both to parents who were themselves on the grant and to parents who were receiving assistance for their children but were not themselves on the grant.
And just maybe this is defined somewhere in the statute, I can't see it, but the term assistance unit.
It is defined, and it's the people who are the people in the household who are receiving assistance.
Are there different?
And there are mandatory members of an assistance unit, and that includes the birth family.
So is subdivision 2 under Section 2, is that the definition of what an assistance unit or the different kinds
that's
of
assistance? Senator, that's the mandatory composition of the assistance unit.
Okay.
Right. Mr. Chair, I apologize. I didn't hear any of that.
Please bring the microphone close and
use your outside voice, as Benson says.
Senator Higgins, I'm sorry that you were unable to hear that from the very beginning, or is there
just the last piece.
Okay, there is a section of the statute, and it actually is one of the sections that we made a very minor change in, so it is on page 13, that lists the mandatory assistance unit composition. That was my response to that issue.
And just so I'm clear, the amendment is clarifying, where, as I understand it, the current statute says that if you are in an assistance unit and you're receiving assistance, then you have an additional child, you do not get an increase in your assistance. And what the amendment is doing is saying if you are not receiving assistance, but your children are receiving assistance and you have an additional child, is that kind of the extent?
We're clarifying that, yes, even though the parent may not, him or herself, be on the receiving assistance. If they are receiving assistance for their children, that then the family cap does apply.
All right, I see. That is the amendment. I understand there's someone that wants to speak in opposition to the amendment. Perhaps you can pull up a chair or just make sure you have access to a microphone. Thank you. Please bring that microphone close.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid. Senator Benson, I apologize. We have not been able to touch base about this. I actually thought maybe the department would be striking this language out based on the fact that we struck it out in the House. But the department knows that Legal Aid has significant concerns with this language in the underlying bill and with this amendment. Legal Aid believes that this language discourages marriage, and we believe that it discourages parents who have been absent, for instance, maybe an absent father, from returning to a household to take responsibility for a child. We have worked with the department. We sent them a number of scenarios in which we thought this language still potentially discourages marriage and discourages parental responsibility. I think maybe they're just agreeing to disagree with us, but we do think there could be unintended consequences of this language. And I still have those concerns. I was just handed this amendment about 5 minutes ago, so I haven't. The only new language that I can see in this would be at 1.10, and I still don't think that answers our attorney's concerns. So we remain opposed to this language in the underlying bill, and I apologize. We also oppose the amendment because we don't think this solves the problem that this family cap language discourages marriage and parental responsibility.
Could you, Ms. Webster, just how does it discourage marriage? And
so I'd like to go back to what the family cap is, just to make sure that all members know what the family cap is. When a mother is on assistance, normally we give people grants based on family size. If a mom has a new baby while she's on assistance, she does not receive more money for that baby. They're capped. The family cap was intended to deter out-of-wedlock pregnancies. What this language, we think, does is it's possible that when two low-income parents come together and they have children they don't share a child in common, but they have a child maybe from another household, it's possible that that child coming into the household by marriage could be capped. And there's a technical piece of the provision that deals with 10 months, that it has to be 10 months after the mom has been on assistance, and so it's a very complicated area of the law, and we think that there are scenarios where either two households come together or where a parent who has been absent comes back to perhaps take responsibility for a child. They don't get married, but he has maybe a child from another marriage, and that child could be capped.
So just let me make sure I understand your objection. So if you have two individuals who have children separately, and they're both on assistance?
No.
They're not. One of them is on assistance.
If one is on assistance and another comes.
One of the adults has a child and is on assistance, the other has a child not on assistance, and they come together. I don't know if this requires marriage, or I'm not sure if the assistance unit requires.
Not necessarily at that moment in time.
So they live together, become, and then you're saying that the child that is on assistance would not continue to get assistance?
I'm saying that the child that comes in, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, the child that comes into that marriage, we have concerns, could potentially be capped.
When you say capped, meaning not eligible for assistance?
Correct.
But they're not on assistance right before, is that correct?
So, Mr. Chair, what we're saying is that you could have mom on assistance, dad very low income, not on assistance. We have concerns that dad might figure out that he could, if he goes on assistance by himself, he'll get help for his child. If he comes and gets with mom, joins with mom, that's possible that his child will not get assistance. So they're better off to stay separate.
So your argument is that to the extent that this discourages people getting on assistance, it could discourage marriage for people who are looking for ways to get assistance. Is that essentially the argument?
Mr. Chair, that is essentially the argument, and there are other scenarios, too, where it's not just that scenario, because I don't think this is the department's intent. The department does not want to discourage marriage and discourage households from joining. That's not the department's intent, and I know that. It's just that the language, we feel, doesn't get us there. So we are disagreeing with the department on where they're at on this.
Senator Berglund, and you have a question?
I'm just wondering if our own staff could come up with some language that might work better than what we've had in front of us so far. Obviously, when two folks are coming together in marriage or otherwise, even when they are low income, they are going to probably, in most cases, raise the income standard of that family and reduce the assistance that would be needed. And they are more likely to get out of poverty. So I don't think it's a very good idea to be discouraging this type of activity. I think the problem is with the drafting, and maybe our own staff could work on some language that would work better.
And Council, I don't know if have you kind of, is that possible under, or do we need to consider laying this aside for a bit and work on language? Or
Mr. Chair, if I just have one question, if we just deleted this section from the bill, which would revert it back to its original, the original section, doesn't that only cap then new children who are born to the mom within 10 months, which then would alleviate this issue?
Well, Chairman, members of the committee, we have concerns that people don't just stay within one unit, whether they marry or not, and that currently, by looking at it in the way that the statute, well, we believe that the statute did intend that you look at that person's time on assistance, the adult's time on assistance, not just what unit they were in at that time. So were you on assistance at the time that the child was conceived? Were you already receiving assistance? And I think that that's what we were trying to clarify here, is that, yes, you do look at that so that you're not applying a different standard if the people were in the unit together and married than you would apply if they were not married and in separate units. And choosing to have another child while receiving assistance for their children. I believe that the amendment, which talks about the combination of units where there aren't children in common, does address the issue of, if I was on assistance with my child, not yours, and you were on assistance with another child that's not mine, if we come together, then there's no penalty for doing that. What we were trying to address, though, is if we were both on assistance and choose to have another child, if we were in one unit, that child would be capped. Should it not be capped if we do it when we're in different units?
I guess what's unclear to me is that there's nothing in the language that sort of favors the idea that these people coming together marry one another. I'm a little concerned about that we would say it doesn't matter whether they come together and for whatever, some period of time or permanently. But shouldn't there be some specificity about that if we want to Ms. Webster's point, favor the idea of people marrying, then shouldn't the language somehow make that clear that there is no penalty if you're married? However, there might be a penalty if you're not and you decide to come together. I'm not sure if that's the right phraseology, but
Chairman, I guess if that were the intent to not discourage marriage, then I think that would be, you know, having something more explicit about being exempt if it's a marriage would be one way of trying to address that issue versus having people moving from unit to unit in ways that might allow them to avoid the cap. That is not contemplated in this amendment. And frankly, you know, I think when we were talking about the family cap initially, conversations were about the fact that when you are working versus being on assistance, that you do not get additional money when you have another child. And so that, you know, the cap was around making this more similar to a work situation, having people considering their resources when choosing to have additional children. But certainly other things could be considered.
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair and committee members, it sounds like we have a lot of work to do on this area of the bill. And the two sides have had opportunity to discuss, but now we have the additional question of how we define coming together and what motivations do we have in creating that kind of family unit. In addition, Senator Newman had significant questions about non-licensed care providers, and I don't perceive that he has gotten comfort with that portion of the bill. And so I'm going to respectfully request that we lay this on the table for continued work.
We do have an amendment before us, so are you going to withdraw the amendment?
I would like to withdraw the amendment.
Senator Benson withdraws the amendment and then moves to lay Senate File 1174 on the table. It's not debatable. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Any other business before the committee? Seeing none, we are adjourned. Thank you.